And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast, where it's Wednesday on the eve of the NBA Finals, the crowning moment in basketball, the most important event of any basketball calendar year, the thing that will decide which team wins the championship, which is the entire point of being in the NBA. And all anybody can talk about is Brian Colangelo's alleged fake Twitter accounts. Kevin Arnovitz, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Unbelievable, huh? You just can't. I'm sitting there on the couch, whatever night last night was, Tuesday night. And I've watched some Warriors-Cavs film, which is all boring because this is the fourth go-around of this crap. And I just, it's 9:30, whatever time it is. I got a beer out of the fridge. I'm going to watch a nice rerun of Silicon Valley with my wife. You know, we're a few episodes behind. And all of a sudden, I see this story. And my initial reaction is, oh, boy, this is going to be a thing. Then I read it, and I'm like, oh, this is fun. I'm kind of glad this is a thing, but my wife's going to be annoyed because of the tyranny of the NBA. And then she starts asking questions like, wait, what? A fake Twitter? What's going on? You got to tell me everything. And then my phone starts blowing up. Who's texting you? Who's calling you? What's going on? It became like an event. This is, I don't even know where to start. I don't know. And it is important to say, there is no proof that this is Brian Colangelo. And the Ringer story by Ben Detrick does not come out and say it's Brian Colangelo. It's actually fairly detailed in its detective work steps and what it does not know for sure and what it does know for sure. So we can't say for sure anything, but boy, is this the weirdest damn thing I can ever remember. Well, in recent years.
Yeah, we sort of graduated from the era of sock puppets to, you know, full on. I don't even know what you would call this. But, I mean, right. So there are a couple pressing questions, right? Like, do we know it's him? And there are various bits of evidence to either substantiate that or refute that, depending on what side you're on. You know, who else would it be? And I sort of have a list here. You know, it could be a family member. It's a child, somebody with a visceral loyalty, an agent. And I don't know if Colangelo has, you know, certain coaches have those sort of administrative assistants that have been with them for years. I'm thinking about Doc Rivers is, since way back, I think in the Orlando days, Anne Marie, I forget her name. So you know, does Brian have, you know, one of those? And, you know, and every time I sort of turn to a possibility, you know, you go back to the followers, you go back to some of the more incriminating tweets, sitting very specific information. I was at the Beijing Olympics, you know, very obscure Canadian ball players that, you know, his son played with, Toronto socialites. So it's tough. I don't have a definitive opinion, but it's damning. It's damning.
It's unbelievable. So here's my list of people it could be. It could be Brian Colangelo. It could be a Brian Colangelo family member or associate. His son was a popular theory last night, but I believe some of the accounts are tweeting about his games during his games, which would seem to disqualify him. It could be the anonymous tipster him or herself, the person who tipped off Ben, could be behind all of these accounts in an elaborate frame job of Brian Colangelo. I don't know how that would work.
Would have to know very, very specific information.
Well, we're going to get there. It could be, yeah. I don't think it's speaking out of school to say that at various times since Brian Colangelo took over for Sam Hinkie, there have been some tensions between the coaching staff and the front office there. Not out of the ordinary on what you would get in an NBA situation right, like that. And the Fultz, whatever, the Fultz anomaly, the Fultz ultimatum, pick your Born movie subtitle for whatever the hell happened to Markelle Fultz this season, exacerbated all of those tensions because there began to be a behind closed doors kind of blame game going on that didn't really trickle out into the media, and that actually kind of surprised me that it didn't. And I think it shows how much that everyone likes the kid that it didn't trickle out into the media. I thought maybe it could be like a rogue coach or something, even though I have no idea who it would be, which one it would be. But then you'd have to think, when the Ringer contacted, according to their reporting, when they contacted Sixers PR about this story, Sixers PR is quoted or described in there as telling Brian Colangelo about the inquiry, and then bam,
and then bam,
3 of the accounts are shut to private. And I don't know that how this rogue coach that I'm theorizing about could have possibly been in on the conversation enough to maybe word got around. I highly doubt it. So I don't
to say nothing of pizza in Beijing.
Yeah,
could be completely fabricated.
Well, and to your point also, like the stuff that is tweeted about Fultz and alluded to about Fultz is incredibly sensitive stuff that not very many people on planet Earth know and has never been publicly reported anywhere. And
that's one of the great problems, right? Like the problem is not that the declarative facts stated are untrue. The problem is many of them are true, which further incriminates.
Well, it's and some of them are confidential and damaging. And I mean, that's the issue. I just don't see how this doesn't end with someone in Philadelphia losing their job, as unpleasant as that is to say, because either it's Brian tweeting this stuff or it's somebody that he or someone else told very sensitive information, then tweeting it public, which the originator of that information to me becomes culpable, even if it's a son of somebody or a family member of somebody, or I don't even know where else to go.
This is how Tim Matheson lost his job as President Bartlett's vice president, right? Like he told that woman that he was having an affair with. It wasn't the crime. It was the conveying of the information.
I didn't like the West Wing. That's a West Wing reference, right?
That is a West Wing reference.
I couldn't get through the West Wing. I don't want to get sidetracked on an Aaron Sorkin thing. This is better than any Aaron Sorkin plot.
This is better than any script.
I just don't know what else to do. And Woj is reporting today that Brian is going around, as you would expect, calling all the people who are the subject of these tweets, Joel Embiid and Markelle Fultz and presumably Jahlil Okafor and Nerlens or whoever else, to say, hey, this wasn't me. I don't know who it is. I can't say for sure it's Brian Colangelo. The evidence doesn't look good, but someone within the Sixers is either doing this or told someone who is doing it the wrong, bad information that person should not have known. And I don't even think it could be like a disgruntled employee that was fired like 6 months ago or a year ago. I don't even know who that would be. I don't even think it could be that.
No, I mean, again, there's current information being divulged. I mean, so. And here's the problem, if the investigation turns up that it is Brian. The most incriminating thing is, number one, he played loose, as you say, with sensitive information. The second thing is, if it is Brian Colangelo, it demonstrates that what he says in day-to-day conversations with players doesn't reflect his true feelings. And so he's compromised, right? Like can't be trusted. Not so much with... both with sensitive information and to basically just be truthful. You're telling a player one thing and then, you know, you clearly have these private feelings, except that they're not private, which is obviously compounds the whole problem. I don't know. Again, every time I come up with, you know, a possible suspect, something doesn't gel. Again, the simultaneously locking of the accounts, if indeed this was only a private conversation between top-level communications people with the Sixers and Colangelo himself.
People within the team are shell-shocked at all levels of the team. Shell-shocked. They cannot believe what's happening. They don't know what's happening. And that's who I feel bad for, honestly. No matter if it does end up being Brian, and again, we don't know. You know, there are lots of people below him who uprooted their lives to go work there, who in the event of a regime change are going to lose their jobs or may lose their jobs. I mean, it's a really, and I'm just, you know, I'm going to withhold judgment because I certainly don't have the technological wherewithal to prove who it is or isn't. I also think it's possible it's Brian. I don't think it's outrageous for it to be Brian. I think anyone who works in the media probably has a story of Brian being upset or responsive in some way about something that they wrote. So as Woj tweeted earlier, it's not it's not insane that it could you want to say it's so dumb. Like one of these accounts tweeted reporters some of this sensitive information. Like so it's not like they're tweeting a Twitter egg that has 25 mentions. They're tweeting a reporter who, if they happen to check their mentions, would see this account saying Jahlil Okafor failed a physical. Check out Markel Fultz's trainer and these videotapes about his shot. Like, that is so reckless that you almost can't believe it could be true, but anything can be true now. And people do crazy stuff online.
So I had a blog called Clipper Blog in 2006.
First of all, don't pretend that people listening to this don't know what Clipper Blog was. I felt like I knew you before I ever met you because of Clipper Blog, which was...
This is relevant. So it turned out that we started seeing some specific comments from someone who clearly was just exceptionally well-versed in team politics. And this is 06. And, but just so specific and so animated in their critiques. And it turned out a couple of years later, when I'm hired by ESPN and now I have access to various people in the game, that one of these individuals I was talking to, and all of a sudden, sort of in a conversation, just BSing with them, they started articulating almost word for word points that I remembered in these comments. Because early on, when you have this blog, and you might have had this experience, like mostly it's just fans and whatever, but every once in a while you get some high level commenters who themselves are actually in some cases actually became contributors, and it was very clear that this person who was very close inside the Clippers was indeed one of the commenters. Actually, he wasn't inside the Clippers, but kind of associated outside. And so it's not sock puppets. I mean, there are incidents in political blogging. Now, Twitter is obviously a different story, but I mean, this is not unusual for very prominent people feeling beleaguered, being very sensitive to criticism, going on online platforms, and posing as anonymous people. If I were for not being able to execute a trade for a player who was both expendable and problematic, and I had evidence that exonerated me, basically, but couldn't divulge, you can imagine that I'd be tempted to release that information into the ether, particularly if I was deeply insecure about my reputation, or, again, if it's not the exec, someone so close to the person emotionally that, on their behalf you would do it. I mean, it's not unusual. There is precedent for this kind of sock puppetry. This platform's terrible, by the way. And it's further evidence to me that it's a completely unhealthy, terrible platform.
You know what the worst result of all of this is? It's proof that we should be checking our mentions, which I preach people never to do, because even if it's only 5% of the mentions are people saying horrible things about you, your work, your family, your large nose, in my case, whatever people are talking to you about, that's going to stick in your head. But now there's the possibility that in not checking your mentions, you're missing, right in plain sight, a giant story. I can't go back to checking my mentions, but one of the lessons of this is that you should check your mail. It's too much. I'm overwhelmed. It's too much.
Yeah, I don't actually use it very much except to disseminate my stuff. Even Instagram, I've kind of deactivated almost from Facebook and Instagram. I decided on Instagram, I just populated my feed 50% with golden retrievers, just cute golden retrievers.
It's sort of instant
therapy now. So when I open this app, it's just really cute golden retrievers. I have some friends, and my friends are still on there. And by and large, Instagram is a less toxic place.
I have some friends.
It's just amazing. Like, it has increased the quality of my life just to have nothing but golden retrievers pretty much on my feed.
I like that you had to specify. Like, I have some friends. I reserved some of my Instagram for my human friends, but mostly it's just – you don't have a dog, do you?
No, I really want one, but my lifestyle doesn't really allow for it. Yeah. I mean, I grew up with like two dogs at a time. I mean, we were a dog family, and I'm desperate for one. I can't do it. I live alone. I'm on the road 120 days a year.
Even Franklin the dog, Philadelphia's mascot. Did you see his tweet today?
It could be Franklin the dog.
He's flying to Mexico. He posted a photo from the gate in the airport. He's literally going to wherever Andy Dufresne is in Mexico to flee. There's no other interpretation I can make than Franklin is fleeing the country. fleeing extradition. I still think the DeAndre Jordan thing is funnier than this. This may be more bizarre, but I don't think, I still don't think this equals the, maybe because it occurred at night, so it wasn't like full peak engagement, like some people were just not on social media. I just don't know that we'll ever have like a six, whatever amount of hours, it was more than six, but that whole day of DeAndre and the humor of it and the kidnapping and where, wait, Mark Cuban's driving where and the emojis, like to me that is still unequaled.
Can I confess? I didn't know until you emailed me this morning that we were going to talk about this. I did a blackout last night. I came back, watched a Westworld, and just, like, I literally woke up to this news. So I was completely...
Westworld...
also, I have this app that I'm not allowed on Twitter more than 10 minutes a day. It's this app that shuts it down.
Is Westworld good?
10 minutes. Yeah, I think if you like that sort of exploration of human consciousness and you know, sort of the implications of artificial intelligence and just sort of... I really like it. It's flawed. It's a deeply flawed series. But I'm just sort of fascinated with those questions in general. And so I just it kind of hits me right in sort of my area of interest.
Yeah, so it seems like a show seems like a show I would like.
I think you'd like it. It asks big questions.
I just don't know what else to say about this. Someone is gonna get fired in Philadelphia, as unpleasant as that is to say. Something horrible has happened here. Or this is, I don't even know how this could be a setup. I just don't know how the person setting this up would know all this information. It's just, it's a shocking turn of events. I do love the speculation that somehow, it's not real speculation. I like the faux speculation that perhaps this is Sam Hinkie's long con. starting with the resignation letter. And he's just been biding his time constructing this elaborate online hoax to take down. I do enjoy the faux spec. I don't know if you've seen it. You probably haven't because you have some sort of app that electrocutes you if you're on Twitter, for more than 10 minutes, but I do enjoy that.
Oh, no, it is both completely improbable and entirely entertaining.
If this is
going on.
To be clear, there is a less than zero chance that Sam Hinkie is involved in any of this.
It's the least Hinkie-ish thing ever.
Like, literally less than zero. However, it does, if this ends badly for the Colangelos, it all does go back to, I don't want to say the inanity, but the idea that, at the very least, the league had to introduce the Sixers owners to Jerry Colangelo. Now, some people would leave it there. The league would surely prefer that we leave it at the verb introduce Colangelo to the Sixers owners. Other people would go much further and insinuate much more. I don't know what the actual story is. I've certainly asked everybody and you hear 9,000 different versions of it. But at bottom, there was enough discontent with what Sam did that an introduction was made. And that introduction led to a chain of events that has now led us here. And it just, you know, look, I think Sam would admit has certainly learned from what happened there. Probably would do things differently if we got another GM job in terms of maybe being more communicative with agents or whatever.
Yeah, external relations, let's call it.
But what he really did was exploit an incentive structure that the league itself set up. And then people within the league were mad that someone said, oh, these are the rules? Oh, the rules suggest that this is the best way to win a championship. Oh, so I'm just, as long as my owners say I can do it, I'm just going to do that. And you're all going to be mad at me because I got the job security and the green light to do that. That seems, did you see his tweet over the weekend when LeBron made the finals? Said almost 40 years of history encapsulated in these names. And it was like LeBron, Jordan, Olajuwon, Bird, Magic. And the subtext was very clear. These guys are picked 1, 1, 1, 3, 6 in Bird's case, but of course he was still in college, yeah. You know, in the draft. I mean, that was the point.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have probably litigated this as much as anyone, and so I don't, you know, really think it. I just wrote something on it the last couple of weeks. I will say this. I thought the league's behavior was authoritarian, and while I hope this wasn't Brian Colangelo, because as you said, many people, the repercussions for a lot of innocent people could be dire. And so I really hope it's not. And also, it's just fun and entertaining, but I hope it's not him. Also, because if it weren't him, it will be even more interesting. But that said, this would be a nice blow against authoritarianism. And the league's just absolutely heavy-handed, unconscionable, just intervention and something they really, again, as you said, a situation they created. So that would be my only comment.
By the way, you may know more about it than I do. I can't use any of those words because I don't know the full story. But I will give Adam Silver credit for this. He's already come out and said the tanking or the lottery odds modifications coming next year. I believe he said something at one of the Board of Governors recently that, you know, that may well not be enough. That may well not do enough to change things. Spoiler alert, it's not going to be. The incentive structure is the same.
Yeah. I'm a huge Adam Silver fan. And again, in the words of, you know, Churchill about America, you know, he always gets it right eventually. And I think that's generally true. I'm a fan, and I'm very happy about the progress. I still think it's just whack-a-mole. I think you wrote a piece about it at a certain point. Well, now it's going to be an incentive to go finish 5, 6, 7, or 7, 8, 9. I forget what it is, but at any rate, let's not.
You know, I've actually been thinking a lot about that recently because, you know, you and I don't want to, let's do cap this. I need an app like your Twitter app to cap this at like 2 minutes to like have a whoopee cushion.
I will say no more on this.
Okay. I've been thinking a lot about this because you have been pro abolishing the draft. Many other thinkers smarter than I have talked about a reverse order draft where the champion gets the first pick or a 30 team lottery where every team has equal odds of getting every pick, or Mike Zarin's wheel where there is no connection between record and pick, and you sort of not randomly, but you bounce around in set increments around the draft. You know, I've always been my rebuttal to all of that. Look, there are many there are issues beyond competitive balance. There's freedom of work issues. There's all that stuff that we're just going to have to leave aside here. But I've always been of the idea that the minute the Warriors get the number one pick in the draft, the minute the Cavs get the number one pick in the draft, the LeBron Cavs, not the we tanked every year and somehow won the lottery Cavs. The minute a great team gets the first pick in the draft, a large number of people who back those reforms are going to say, oh boy, we've just enabled a dynasty to get even better. And I'm not sure, we reckoned properly with the implications of that. But as I've been sitting here thinking about both the Cavs and the Warriors and thinking about not the fragility of great teams, because they're not fragile. The Warriors are going to be great for a long time. The Cavs maybe not so much. You know, I do think there is something to the idea of, you know, picking 30th every year. It just, you got no shot. You got very little shot at sustaining beyond when your star players age. And maybe that's okay. Maybe that's okay. But I've been thinking a lot about this in relation to the Cavs, particularly because if LeBron leaves, they're toast. And they did many, many things to get themselves into toast status. But maybe some sort of system where at least some of those teams, you know, get to pick 15th every couple of years or something. I'm just thinking out loud because most championship teams end in ruins, and most of them end in ruins because they have no chance to acquire a good player in the draft. And the Spurs and Kawhi are obviously an exception to that. But anyway, just food for thought. Let's move on. Cause you said no more.
I have so much to say, but I'm not going to say anything.
Listeners, you know, you got to brush your teeth every day, but the truth is a lot of us are brushing our teeth wrong, and you got to change the way you do it. And Quip is the electric toothbrush that helps you do that. It's not some flashy gimmick. It doesn't cost you $1 million. It's an electric toothbrush that's a fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes. It's not bulky either. And it packs just the right amount of vibrations and other tools to help you clean your teeth right. It has a built-in timer to help you clean your teeth for 2 minutes and 1 minute on each side. It tells you when to switch sides. That's very handy. It has a subscription plan. They deliver new brush heads on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping. That's nothing. It comes with a mount that suctions right up to your mirror and unsticks. It's easy to travel with. Everybody seems to love Quip. It was on Oprah's O-List. It was one of Time's best inventions. And it is the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. That seems important. They have a network of 20,000 dentists and hygienists and hundreds of thousands of happy brushers, to tell you how great Quip is. It starts at just $25. I would think an electric toothbrush would cost like $100. $25 if you go to getquip.com/Lowe, L-O-W-E, my last name, Lowe, and you'll get your first refill pack free with the Quip electronic toothbrush. That's right, your first refill pack free if you go to getquip.com/Lowe, L-O-W-E. That's G-E-T-Q-U-I-P, getquip.com/Lowe. The finals are here. Cavs Warriors 4. You know, I'm going to write this in my column tomorrow. I've seen a lot of, there have been a lot of, like, I'm surprised how many columns there are that have been essentially scolding people, like preemptive scolding of people who are bored with the finals. I think it's okay to be bored with these finals. Like, I'm not super psyched about the finals. I was kind of like, I'd like to spend a week in Houston. I'd like to hang in Boston for a little while. I'd like to see some fresh blood. Like, I think it's, I'm not going to sit here and be the NBA writer who, like, tells you why you shouldn't be bored with the NBA finals just because I'm excited about the NBA finals. I'm not that excited. I'm going to be honest. I'm not that excited. Are you excited?
Nah, I'm not all that excited. I mean, it might have to do with what I see as, you know, just one team I feel like is decidedly better than the other. However, my all the more reason I would become excited if this became a competitive series. The element of surprise would kind of stoke that. But I'm not overly excited. Then again, I do, you know, it's funny. I'm not overly excited yet. I'm glad LeBron is in the finals because the finals are better with LeBron. And I'm glad the Warriors are in the final because I think they play the most attractive brand of basketball in the Western Conference. And I just didn't want to see, you know, I like the Warriors, like the Rockets organization. I generally succeed. I like a lot of those players. I didn't really particularly want to watch James Harden do James Harden things for 2.5 weeks. So on one hand, I'm not all that excited. On the other hand, I think the superstar who provides the marquee and the team that to me is just most appealing. Just in terms of aesthetics. That's it. I'm not rooting for the Warriors. I think it's an attractive brand of basketball that's been good for the league.
Yeah, I like how you put it. Sort of for right now, the possibility of a miracle is exciting. Right. If they go down 2-0 and lose at Oracle by 40 combined in games 1 and 2, which has been about what's happened in the last two finals, that's not that sort of possibility intrigue is gone. And we just have, you know, another one of these finals. It's more that I'm just sort of like, how many times can I watch LeBron find where Steph Curry is guarding, call that guy up to set a pick, have him set a pick, you get a switch or you don't get a switch, you back him dead. It's like how many times, it's a million times now. Just, I feel like I can close my, and here's Kevin Love. Okay. The Cavs are going to attack Kevin Love and pick and roll defense. And there are some new pieces. Obviously the Cavs got a brand new team halfway through the season. Iguodala's hurt. That's kind of interesting. Like I just feel like I've seen the schematics of this over and over and over and over.
Something happened, Zach, which is that, in this revolution of the game, you know, and trace it back to whoever you want as the intellectual godfather, but the idea that we play positionless basketball and like-sized players who can do it all, and this is great for the game. I mean, we all love this revolution. So what happens is, defensively, this sort of the preeminence of the switch, right? Because now you can switch everything because you have like-sized players who can defend on the perimeter and sort of hold their own in the post. So now we have this switching scheme, and it's kind of interesting, and teams are succeeding with it, and it's counterintuitive, and change is good, right? Change is good. Yeah, we play defense the Thibodeau way for a while, and now we're doing this, and with some exceptions, obviously. Not every team switches, but a lot of the prominent teams do switch. And so now what do we get? Despite this very exciting revolution and this sort of change, and change is good, what do we get? A bunch of mismatch frigging basketball. A bunch of let's hunt the Steph Curry mismatch. Let's hunt the Kevin Love mismatch. Let's hunt the Kevon Looney mismatch. You know, least capable of defender on the floor, run a pick and roll, and I just think it's boring. And part of my lack of excitement has somewhat to do with that. As you said, I love watching LeBron play. But unintended consequences are funny things. And what we got with this awesome revolution was, a few years later, everybody adapts, and now we have a bunch of mismatched basketball, and, you know, it's somewhat unappealing. And I think it does. It's one of the reasons, you know, it's a little less exciting. I mean, hopefully the Warriors can mitigate that a little bit. Not that they, as you say, they don't exploit it themselves. And Durant makes it a little less interesting schematically, but he's kind of cool too to watch play. But it is, this does reflect, like, there was something kind of about the, as exciting as those series were, just from a purely aesthetic standpoint, basketball's, yeah, less attractive than it was a couple years ago.
Yeah, it's interesting. It is interesting. And look, we've all been writing about this for years now. Like, I wrote a piece about how the post-up game will have a revival or is not really dead because of this. Last year, I wrote a piece about the 1-3 pick and roll being the new play that you have to have precisely because you take the littlest guy on the other team, and that's like your weakness of last resort. But it's just like Rockets Warriors is like the apex of NBA basketball, and it just turned into until the Warriors got loose or when the Warriors got loose and their system started to work. And maybe that's the brilliance of what they do is that it's just you can't keep that system down for an entire game, or it's very hard to do it. Eventually they're going to get let loose. But I think that's part of the reason why, for instance, the Sixers are exciting. The Sixers have one old school throwback big man and whatever Ben Simmons is, and they present, and as you wrote so eloquently throughout the playoffs, they're like the Warriors in that they just run like no pick and roll relative to the rest of the league. They're interesting. The Jazz
come for our cool schemes, stay for our Twitter scandals.
The Jazz with Gobert are just, they play, they just can't play the switching style that a lot of teams play. The Nuggets with Jokic and without sort of a traditional pick and roll point guard are kind of stylish. So there's always going to be these teams that are against this grain, but at the absolute tip top of basketball, you get the teams that are like sized and switchy, and that's the way they attack each other. And it was fine. Like, I liked watching it. It's still basketball. I don't want to be the guy sitting here complaining about basketball. It's great fun, watching these games, but it's just sort of stylistically, it's just objectively kind of interesting that this is where we've ended up in 2018. We'll end up somewhere else next year and in 2020, but right now this is where it is.
Yeah. Again, I like a diverse ecosystem, like you said. Like, to me, the league is awesome when there's as much distinguishing characteristics between teams. And so, yeah, you're always going to have an isolation team. But anyway, so, yeah, I like the participants, but I also, again, I'm semi-excited. I put my excitement scale on a 6.5.
Also, the first two games ever since 2015 when LeBron did the touchdown spike at the end of game two have just been 20-point Warriors blowouts every time. And LeBron has said many times, like, his worst playoff game of this playoffs was game one against Boston. Game one's a feel-out game for me. Well, if game one's a feel-out game, they're going to lose. And if they lose game one, then they've got to be competitive in game two because they're just not going to beat the Warriors 4 out of 5. It's not going to happen. So I hope these first two are competitive, and I'm certainly interested. And I don't think Andre is going to play the first one, and maybe not the first two. So at least maybe there's a puncher's chance here. But I just... the talent disparity is so great, and you saw it against Houston once Paul went out. I mean, Houston could get up 15 in these games, and then the third quarter starts, and it's bam, 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 bam. The Warriors are ahead.
So what do we think the Cavs are going to do curveball-wise? I mean, they haven't been afraid to trap at times, and, the Warriors having a big alongside Green would make it easier because
if they do,
having a Iguodala, right? We know the Cavs will try to beat the crap out of the Warriors physically. Thompson will just, pancake defenders on the screen. That'll trigger some help. That'll leave Cavs shooters open. It'll leave the glass vulnerable. And so we know that that'll happen. I mean, what else? What else haven't we seen in 3 years? Granted, it's a different team that they'll try to sort of throw.
Well, you mentioned that they've trapped, and they've actually been okay on some of their pick-and-roll defense against Steph, trapping, even with Love. If I recall last year, they actually gave up more points when Love was on the back line of defense instead of at the front line trapping Steph. I think the most interesting, so last year, they had no choice but to have LeBron guard Kevin Durant. And it just seems untenable for him to be able to do that for 30 minutes a game, let's say. So you give some to Jeff Green, you give some to whoever. And carry their offense in a way that he now has to because Kyrie Irving is on the Celtics and Isaiah Thomas is somewhere. So that has raised an interesting question of should the Cavaliers just start Jeff Green? Is their best chance to start Jeff Green, put him on Durant, let LeBron have a less taxing assignment like Draymond Green or whoever, well, basically just Draymond Green, or Iguodala if they start Iguodala eventually. And then, who do you start Jeff Green for? Do you start him for Tristan Thompson so that you keep Love at center and you have some offense-defense balance? Or do you start him for Kevin Love because they looked pretty damn good defensively in Game 7 against Boston and just go with this, like, 2015 style like when they had just all these grinders after Kyrie got hurt and LeBron, and just try to win that way. I am with you, and I'm going to write this in a column, so I'm spoiling it now, but I don't like either of those choices all that much, because
I was going to say, I'm rifling through them, and they're both unacceptable.
To me, you watch what Capella did to them in Game 7, and if you're Cleveland and you're an underdog like this, your only chance is that Tristan Thompson plays the entire series like that. That he gives you 20. It's not going to be 40 because they're not going to guard him, and it's going to muck up your offense a little bit, even if he's working as a screener and mashing people, as you said, and blah, 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 and, all that. But between his switching on defense and just his physicality and his rebounding, and I just think they're going to need 28 to 30 mashing Tristan Thompson minutes to have any chance in this series. And also, it's not a curveball, but I do think they have to go back somewhat to that 2015 style where they just play possession football, basically. They just run the ball. They just do the equivalent of running the ball. We're going to run the shot clock down. We're going to play slow. We're going to take you out of your transition game and try and make this an 85 possession game, because that's our only chance.
Yeah, Thompson's such an interesting player for me, because by and large, I will always take the stretch over the grit, and yet he is so indispensable to what they're trying to do with a lesser roster, right? It is, he provides physicality because of the switching and the sort of the chaos defense. There are vulnerabilities on the opposing glass that he can take advantage of. He defends the perimeter really well, which is, as you say, in a switch series, is just vital. So against all of my sensibilities, I just really like Thompson being on the floor as much as possible. And I also am just, while being a very nice guy, Jeff Green is one of my least favorite basketball players. I know he found some acorns in Game 7 from the right corner. I just don't love it. And frankly, I just don't even think he's all that capable against Durant. I mean, I just don't. I know he's got size.
Well, that's part of what's interesting, right? Is like, no one can guard. We do this with LeBron, like, oh, he can guard Durant. No one can guard Durant. So I just sort of wonder if you're better off just let's just say they start their current starting lineup. Like, if Love can play Game 1, Hill, Smith, LeBron, Love, and Thompson. And so nominally, LeBron is guarding Kevin Durant. There's no other choice. You can't put JR on him. You can't put Love on him. There was like a groundswell last season to try Tristan Thompson on him so that LeBron didn't have to guard him. You can't do that. But what if you just said, okay, so we don't want LeBron running around with KD all the time. Why don't we just, those are our five best players. If you want to include Korver in that list, fine. They're not going to start Korver. Those are our five players we trust the most.
Can I interrupt for a second?
Yeah.
This is totally a parlor game. I'm not even prescribing it. Well, what happens if Tristan Thompson starts on Durant? Exactly what happens?
Well, this is...
Is that just... You can't do it because... Like, and I, look, I'm not... I need to think this through. I'm just throwing it out there. But I want to kind of think aloud about this. Like, is it just insane?
I don't think it's... I think one of the lessons of this, of the playoffs, is that none of these things are insane. Almost nothing is insane, particularly when you...
And help is a call away, right? Like, help is always a call
right.
away.
Right. And particularly when you're the underdog. Like, I remember, this is now 4 or 5 years ago. I'm not going to say what team or what player it was, but it was a player who's a defensive liability. And I just randomly said, hey, one thing I might try is putting this player on that bad offensive player on the other team. And it was a wacky suggestion because one of the players was giant and one of the players was very small. And the defensive liability happens to be someone I know in the league and texted me and said, man, you really suggest coach puts me there? Dude, come on, man. That's disrespectful. That's crazy. The next game, they tried it. And from that moment on, I have reminded myself, if there's even a part of my brain that this is like a self-confidence exercise for me. Like, if there's even a part of my brain that thinks it might be worth trying, have the confidence to think a coach on the other team probably doesn't think it's one of the assistant coaches probably doesn't think it's crazy either. So I don't think, to your point, like I don't think it's crazy, but here's where I was going was, what if you just start those five And instead of saying LeBron has to guard KD, he's like, we switch everything. We're going to switch it. Maybe you switch everything except Steph pick and rolls involving Love. Maybe you blitz those, switch everything else. And yeah, you know what? That's going to leave.
Wait, remind me who we have on Durant now in this game.
Well, you start with LeBron, but as Durant runs around the floor, you just go, okay, Hill's got him. JR's got him. And yeah, you know what? Those are bad matchups. But now
Durant just works in isolation.
But I think what the Rockets showed you is if you get them to slow down, and Durant isolates against J.R. Smith, the ball stops, and I can get myself ready to help off of Looney and help off of Draymond or help off of Andre and just sort of make him take maybe George Hill gets into his stomach and is a pain in the ass a little bit. Make him take a lot of long twos, and you know what? It's a losing strategy. You're going to lose. Probably going to lose anyway. And there are going to be games where he shoots 65% on those shots and you just throw your hands up. But I don't know that that's like a terrible option. Maybe it is. Maybe it's just insane. I don't know.
I mean, they're going to have to resort to insanity at certain points. Because, again, as you say, the talent disparity is there.
I mean, I don't think LeBron James, as godlike as he has been, can hound Kevin Durant for 30 minutes a game, handing off him to Jeff Green the rest of the time and score 35 points on 55% shooting and have 10 assists and block a shot at the rim here or there to be in. I just think we've now reached a point where he doesn't get to guard Jaylen Brown or he doesn't get to guard Bogdanovich or whoever he guarded with the Raptors, Ibaka. And I just don't know that he can do everything. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it just decreases the probability that he's able to be God.
And if he's not God, they got no shot. True. Their checklist for having a shot is LeBron is God still. George Hill becomes peak George Hill every single game. Like 20 points, 18 points, 50% shooting on threes, good defense, switches onto Durant and doesn't get completely buried. Kevin Love has a great series. Korver shoots 50% from three. The Warriors have a bad shooting series. Andre never comes back. All these things. If 80% of those things happen, yeah, the Cavs are in it. But that's a lot of things. What else? What are you looking for? What's something you're interested in? You asked me about curveballs. What are you interested in? Maybe you're interested in the Warriors. Like, what do the Warriors do? If Andre can't go game one, do you start Looney and just stick with it?
Yeah, I start Looney. I mean, you know, there might be a certain point where the series demands Livingston. You know, one of the things I just miss, and everybody says about Iguodala, is I just think the Warriors, it all functions better when there are multiple ball handlers. And, like, I mean, that's the Warriors, right? I mean, the Warriors are the Warriors. Obviously, they have great individual talent. But ultimately, like, when Klay Thompson is your least capable playmaker, like, how good are you? And so I think that, like, Livingston obviously is a really limited player, but he's long, but more importantly, he can pass the ball. He can execute any number of things when he has the ball, capably. And if you back a guy in and dish it off to the weak side, I mean, so that's the only thing that I wonder is, to me, the peak Warriors-ness is we have everybody on the floor can essentially do everything. And Livingston over Looney, you know, I appreciate that a little more, especially if you know what, if the Cavs are just going to hunt mismatches. You know, I mean, Looney did well. He acquitted himself well. I like it. I liked it in the last series. But I kind of like Livingston as the what did you used to call that lineup? Not the death lineup.
The coma lineup. The coma lineup.
I like the coma lineup against the Cavs.
The coma lineup has barely played this year.
I know.
I thought it didn't play enough. And I think it's a good lineup. Livingston is one of those bellwether players. Like, if he makes shots, they don't lose. Like, if Livingston gives you 10 points of mid-range jumpers or 8 points of mid-range jumpers, they just don't lose. Same token, like, Draymond, it feels like, has not hit a three in ages or since the clutch three, I believe, in game 5 against Houston that, you know, was followed up by the Quinn Cook miss and the turnover. If he makes shots, you lose. So Livingston's interesting in that regard. It's just, isn't it amazing that Looney has become, after they declined his option, has become the center of choice?
What does he get in the offseason?
I don't think that much.
Yeah. There's always a team that'll pay a little bit of a premium for the special sauce, but there's no market for big men.
No, you know, I don't think he gets the mid-level, for instance. He's not proven that. I mean, the guy can barely jump around the rim or finish any layups. Yeah, I mean, you know, look, I don't – maybe we're all going to be wrong and this is going to be a much more interesting series than we think, but a lot has to go right. And, you know, if LeBron loses another finals, I just don't – I don't know how you hold that against him. It's just, you know, his run to this point – I mean, I run some numbers in my column that's hopefully going to come out. His numbers to this point, I mean, this is arguably the greatest playoff run for any player ever. He's scoring 34 points a game on 54% shooting, 9 assists, 9 rebounds. It's absolutely crazy what he's done.
One of the great, I think, questions and kind of sports bar questions is how much can one man do in sports, right? Baseball, it doesn't really factor in because even your Pedro is only starting every fourth or fifth day and you have four, you know, every ninth at bat. You know, football, for all the quarterback being the most important position in sports, and I'm not going to contest that, the guy's on the field for half the time. And, you know, basketball just lends itself to a certain elasticity for individual performance. I mean, you can go 48. You can take half the shots. You can control and dictate the terms for every possession. And, you know, how much can one man do? And our general answer to that question over time has been, only so much. And he is, like, this year, he is totally challenging the limits of that answer, right? How much can one man do? And the answer is infinite amounts. And if indeed they win this series, like, it will completely redefine that question.
If they win this series, I mean, we're getting way ahead of ourselves. If they win this series, he will have... I don't even want to say it. Like because it's too early to say. But if they win, it will be extraordinary. Buying tickets, listeners, it used to be overwhelming. Did I miss a deal on the secondary market? I got to check 20 different websites to make sure I got the right deal. Wait a second, did I check where exactly the seats are? Is it an obstructed view? Did I miss a great deal over here? SeatGeek has changed all of that. It's the smartest, easiest way to get tickets to any type of live event, an NBA Finals game, for instance, a comedy show, a Broadway show. They help me get tickets to Hamilton, of all things, a concert. It saves you time and it saves you money. It collates all of the secondary market into one place so you don't have to type in 20 different sites. You just go to one. It has an easy, color-coded system to tell you if you're getting a good deal, an undermarket deal, an expensive deal, where the seats are, what the seats typically cost. It's very easy to use. It's fully guaranteed. So you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. You should make it your go-to app for finding the best deals on all these kinds of tickets. And right now, my listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. That can be a high percentage of like a baseball game or a concert ticket. All you have to do, download the SeatGeek app. Enter promo code LOW, L-O-W-E, today. That's promo code LOW, my last name, the name of this podcast, for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Who's a random player that you think might emerge or reemerge? Let's get really crazy. Give me a bench guy who you think on either team who you think, like, you know what? Maybe there's a role for that guy in this series, or I could see that guy having a little sneaky kind of impact in the series. Anyone come to mind?
You know, I know there's always the comic relief part of Nick Young, but, like, you know, one of the interesting things is talking to Warriors people and just how completely satisfied they've been with his defense. And, you know, you forget he's a big, strong guy in addition to being a complete goofball. So, you know, we always assume, you know, he was a shooter on some crappy teams and didn't really care much about that. And, you know, the Warriors basically told him, like, you will play if you defend this year. And so he started defending. And obviously, you know, if and when they decide just to go, you know, Draymond at the five, they're going to, and especially if Iguodala's out, they're going to be minutes on the wing. And if he drains shots, like, you know, game over. And he can defend. It hasn't been terrible. It's actually been quite good.
Nance, maybe? If you want to take everything we said about Tristan Thompson and apply it over 48 minutes, then Nance has to play and play well, and he reemerges a key rotation guy against the Celtics. You know, I wonder, just because of size and theoretical skill set, if Rodney Hood gets dusted off at some point in the series. But, I mean, you could say that about anyone. He just has inspired no confidence at all. But I could see them trying. I don't know. trying him, but I don't know that it will work.
Yeah, theoretical Rodney Hood is a really good player. And just exactly as you say, the properties you'd want, you know, at a two or a three in this series. It's a shame.
Except really his wingspan is shorter than George Hill's wingspan. He's got those T-Rex. He's got those T-Rex.
Yeah, like the J.J. Redick wingspan.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. Like, Utah Rodney Hill was, there were questions about him, as we've talked about, but, like, he was a productive player. Like, this is not, like, if they, everyone's laughing at their acquisition of Rodney Hill, and, like, if they just, or Rodney Hood, rather, I don't know why I said Hill, if they had just gotten the Rodney Hood who played for the Jazz, they'd be totally thrilled with that. Like, I remember a game in Orlando this year, Rodney Hood dropped, like, 35 on a million threes. And we just haven't seen that guy at all. He just takes these bad floaters and moves on with life. Have you made your pick yet?
Yeah, I mean, they ask. I mean, the very conventional Warriors in five.
Is anyone not going to pick Warriors in five? Or the pit? Let me see if the picks are up yet. I picked Warriors in five, too. Some people will pick Warriors in six. Interestingly, Jalen Rose is convinced the Cavs are winning at least two games, including one of the first two, which would be pretty awesome, honestly, if we had that much suspense at any point in the series. Let me see who's picked so far. Warriors in seven, Ian Begley. Jeremias Engelman has them in seven. No one has picked, zero people picked the Cavs. A bunch of sixes. There are a bunch of sixes. Chris Herring with the gutsy, I bet more of us wish we had the guts to make the pick of Warriors in four. He's the only one that's going sweep. Everyone's giving LeBron a game at least, which I think is proper. I think LeBron should be afforded such respect.
Yes, I agree. That was the nominal LeBron game.
Was there any part of you that wanted to pick a sweep? Did you like have four in your email and then like look at it as the cursor was blinking at you and then hit delete and put five?
No, because it's one of those things that like, oh, even if they only have a 25% chance to win games, that the probabilities, and at the end of the day, I just kind of go with that. I'm boring. you know, it's like, the probabilities are they're going to win a game, right? Like they just are probably. But the sweep is totally a tenable situation.
Well, I will see you soon at one of these games. Your analysis is always interesting and spot on, and everyone loves when you come on the pod. So the pod. I don't like when people say the pod. The podcast. What else should we be looking for? You got anything in the works that you want to say or we should be looking at? Last week, you and Kevin Pelton wrote your long-awaited The Evolution of the NBA and Pace and all that story, which was wonderful. Anything you want to mention?
No, because I have a really interesting assignment tomorrow night that I'm excited about, and it'll appear, the results of which will appear before game two. I mean, not that it's any, like, you know, great clandestine thing, but I just kind of need to keep it under wraps. But, yeah.
Cool.
A really interesting assignment tomorrow night, which is totally new for me. So I'm kind of
psyched. Ooh, now I'm intrigued. All right. Well, go get ready for that. Kevin Arnovitz, enjoy game one in San Francisco. Thanks for joining us, and I'll see you soon, buddy.
Thanks for having me.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.